This week on One Hit Wondering, author Scott Heim joins me to discuss albums by Charlene and Tom Tom Club. Plus, we have an interview with Charlene herself, who gives us some insight into the making of her album, I've Never Been to Me, and the hit song it spawned. Stay tuned. John Mark Lapham, and you're listening to One Hit Wondering, the show that takes bands that are generally known as one-hit wonders and pushes their big hit aside to examine the often overlooked album it came from. Was it unfairly dismissed, or did it deserve to be buried? That's what we're here to find out. Each episode, myself and special guests are going to look at two such albums to see if we can find that answer. Now, here at One Hit Wondering, we have no strict definition for what officially makes an artist a one-hit wonder. We'll basically be choosing bands who had one big hit in the U.S. that they became known for better or for worse. We'll primarily be looking at pop songs from the 50s to the 90s that will range from one-off novelty tunes, obscure gems, and massive songs that everybody knows. Before we begin, I'd like to tell you a little bit about the sponsor for this program, Dream Spectrum Marketing. Over 80% of customers search for local businesses online. Dream Spectrum Marketing can help boost your business immeasurably by utilizing SEO, site optimization, and online content marketing, including social media and blogging. If you want to increase your business and beat your competitors online, contact Dream Spectrum today at 1-800-291-2924 or go online now to dreamspectrum.com. Now, please welcome to the show my first guest. Scott Heim is the acclaimed author of the novels We Disappear, In Awe, and Mysterious Skin, which was made into a film by Greg Araki in 2005. Most recently, Scott compiled a series of musical essays into books entitled The First Time I Heard. Scott Heim, welcome.
Thanks, John Mark.
So, Scott, would you say you're a fan of popular music?
I think fan might be a little bit of an understatement, but yeah, I definitely grew up with a mother who had a gigantic collection of 8-tracks and albums, and luckily for me, it was sort of a really wide range of music. So ever since I was a kid, I've listened to sort of everything, sadly, except classical, but not everything popular, everything country, rock, soul, R&B, everything. So yeah, it's always been sort of in my blood.
Sadly, my mom seemed to only listen to Bee Gees, Neil Diamond, and Ray Conniff, and they were all on 8-track, so it was a little limited.
My mom listened to that too, but she was into lots of other stuff too. So
let's talk about now. Do you tend to play it cool with your friends and your what you listen to, or do you openly admit to loving some cheese as far as music goes?
I openly admit to everything. I have a playlist on my iTunes and my iPod that I have labeled SAP, and it's basically like the sappiest stuff from the 70s. But for me, I sort of seriously love it. Like even though I call it SAP, or maybe jokingly call it cheesy to some people, even the bands and artists that are kind of teased the most, like things like Air Supply and Bread, I just love all that stuff. It doesn't have any sort of ironic or cheese ball quality really to me. I take it all seriously. I really love it. So yeah, the idea of doing someone like Charlene to the show is just amazing to me, because you know, I know that her big hit is still sort of, you know, kind of seen as this funny thing by a lot of people who maybe hear it for the first time now, but I love stuff like that.
I do too. I don't really relate to when people call this sort of music guilty pleasures, because there's no guilt on my part at all. I just really like it.
I know, I feel the same way. Exactly.
It's not ironic. I mean, growing up, Charlene, as an example, like, when I was a kid, you were not allowed, as a young boy, you were not allowed to say that you liked music like that, or you get your ass kicked. You know, but then later on, as I was growing up, you know, I kind of liked it, but it was kind of ironic, and you know, you make jokes about it. And then even up till recently, like I always kind of thought, well, you know, that's just it's a great song, sort of a novelty maybe or whatever, you know. But over the last few weeks, I've been, you know, researching Shirley and listening to this song a lot and watching a lot of videos. And I have to say, I just now I'm at a point where I can say it's just really a good song and I really like it. And, you know, I don't care. You know, if it, I mean, yes, there is sort of a Harlequin romance novel aspect to it, but I like that, you know, it's good.
Right.
I think, I think these days, popular music, there's a fear of being taken too seriously or there being too much drama, you know, and I'm a sucker for drama.
I definitely agree.
Yeah. Oh, well, what are you going to do? So while we're on the question of popular music, you've written a series of books, or compiled a series of books, I guess, called The First Time I Heard. What's that all about?
Yeah, I've just always sort of been interested in the stories people tell about the first time they actually heard, like, a specific iconic musician or band or someone, you know, who influences them. So, I don't know, it's something I'd talked about to a lot of other writers and some of my musician friends. And then I thought, oh, maybe this would make kind of a cool book project. So I decided to sort of edit these collections where musicians or writers tell about the first time they heard a specific artist. And I contacted a lot of people through Facebook or through their websites, and it was amazing to me how many people were excited about it and wanted to actually participate. So I got a lot of different musicians, people, you know, that I admire, that I wrote directly to, who, you know, wrote 500 to 1,000 word, really sort of short pieces. But yeah, I've done books now on David Bowie and Joy Division and Kate Bush, and just have one coming out soon on My Bloody Valentine, and I have other ones like Roxy Music coming up soon. It's been fun. First album we're going to be looking at is by Charlene. It's the same name as her big hit single, I've Never Been to Me. This album actually came out in 1982. There was another version of this album that came out in the 70s when the single was released for the first time, and it didn't do very well. It stalled like at number 98, I think, in the pop charts and disappeared. And it wasn't until about 5 years later, I think there was a DJ in Florida who started playing I've Never Been to Me on the radio for his girlfriend. And it just suddenly took off from there. Charlene got a call that she had to come. She was living in England at the time. She had to come back to the States. And like it seems like overnight she was on Good Morning America. And just, you know, it was just going insane all around this one single. And they had to put together another version of the album, which is totally different from the 70s version. It was nuts. I remember seeing her on Solid Gold at that time. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, you couldn't help but notice that song. I mean, it was so different from anything going on, especially in 82, you know. I mean, the charts were filled with synth pop and new romantics and, you know, 80s mm-hmm. pop rock. So this was just so different. And at first listen, it did seem a little cheesy. Of course, I was very young, so I didn't understand the adult themes in it. But I did like it as a kid, even though, like I said before, I wasn't really able to admit it. But I do remember seeing her on Solid Gold, and I actually recently watched a clip of Marilyn McCoo singing I've Never Been to Me. Maybe not have been Marilyn's finest moment.
but it was no Charlene.
It was no Charlene, but then what is Charlene except for Charlene? Oh, goodness. So we're going to obviously have to talk about the big hit song with this album, but we'll try not to focus on it too much because, you know, that's what everyone talks about with Charlene. So we'll try to give her album at least a little bit of the spotlight for a short time. So, yeah, so we'll get into it. Any first thoughts? You press play. The first song, Never Been to Me, of course. This version on this album has the spoken word middle section that was, I think it was taken out of the 70s version, and Charlene seems convinced that's why it became a big hit in the 80s, because it kind of grounded that song.
That's interesting that she would say that, because that's kind of a question I had on my own, if it would have been such a big hit without that. I think in a way it sort of makes the song more intimate and kind of personalizes it more, so... For the people who really sort of were romanced by the song or took it really seriously, I think were really attracted to that part. But then I also think on the other end of things, the people who sort of saw it as cheese ball, as something sort of almost novelty sort of song, were probably attracted to it because of that spoken word part also.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm a sucker for a good spoken word section of a song, like Skeeter Davis, The End of the World, things like that. I always think it's good. So it's a very sort of 50s, 60s sort of pop concept, which I really like.
Hey, you know what paradise is? It's a lie, a fantasy we create about people and places as we'd like them to be. But you know what truth is? It's that little baby you're holding, and it's that man you fought with this morning, the same one you're going to make love with tonight. That's true. That's love.
I think there was a resurgence of this appreciation of this song, or hate of this song, I guess, depending on who you ask, around when Priscilla, the Queen of the Desert, came out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I rewatched that recently. That's a really great performance that Hugo Weaving does of this song at the beginning.
That's right at the beginning of the movie, right?
Uh-huh, yeah. But she loves this song. I really like that she doesn't try to disown it or isn't sick of talking about it. She's very proud of it, which I think she should be. Her voice is beautiful. I think it sounds great on this song. Nothing to be ashamed of there.
But I ran out of places and friendly faces because I had to be free. I've been to paradise, but I've never been.
Okay, so the second track, Ain't Easy Coming Down, I think that's her second favorite one on the album. I believe you told me that it was the follow-up to Never Been to Me. Is that correct?
I think so. And I'm sort of in some ways surprised that it did become a bigger hit. I wonder if maybe in some, I don't know, in some ways it's very similar, just at least in kind of... soft rock pace and sound. I guess it's similar to I've Never Been to Me. I wonder if but that doesn't always hurt a song. It's sometimes things, you know, are hits because they sound similar to the song that came before. So it's curious to me why this wasn't even half as big a hit as the first one was.
Yeah. I kind of question if maybe there was already a little bit of a backlash in play at that point, because I know that, I mean, Never Been to Me was very polarizing. People either really loved it or they really hated it. There was very little middle ground. So I wonder if, unless she made another song that was just as catchy as that first one, which this one wasn't. I mean, I think it's a good song, but it's not quite as, you know, powerful. And I really like track 6, I Won't Remember Loving You. It sounds a lot like Bread. I love that band Bread.
Yeah, I noticed that sort of, I'm not, that sort of tremolo, kind of wah-wah sound guitar. That's the song that opens with that sound, right?
Exactly, and, yeah, that's the one.
Yeah, and it's very much like the opening to that song, If.
It is, that's exactly what I was thinking. Yeah, it sounds just like If.
So yeah, the first time I heard it, the first thing I heard was, it sounds like Yes, by Brad. And I think a similar sound is used on, I think, 3 different songs on the album. But on that one, it's definitely much calmer.
Yeah, I totally agree. That's the one where, like, you almost for a second think you are listening to Brad. It's that similar, which has got to be a good thing, I think. That kind of leads us to another reason why I think she was having a hard time finding ongoing success in the 80s is because this all sounds very 70s. It's 70s adult contemporary, which I think would have worked if these songs had come out in the 70s, because, I mean, you know, Debbie Boone, You Light Up My Life, and all that was going on. But I think in the 80s, the tide was really changing, and, you know, New Wave was in fashion, and it was definitely geared towards a younger audience, I think. And these songs just, they were not going to find popular favor, I think, at that time, you know, especially going from 82 onwards, it would have been really difficult.
Well, certainly if someone just came up and asked the average person, you know, like a trivia question, what year was I've Never Been to Me released, I'm sure they would think it was the 70s. And I guess it originally was, but maybe you're right. I mean, that it does sound much more 1976 than it does 1982.
Yeah. It's a shame that they weren't able to create an album at that time, because we were talking about that, and she said that all these songs on this 80s album were basically just thrown together from her sessions from the 70s. You know, so it was more of a compilation than anything. So there wasn't much vision there for what was going on, and I think she followed it up quickly with an album of new material, but it was, I think by that point she had already kind of gone out of favor.
Was this her first one that was on Motown in America?
The label she was on in the 70s was Prodigal, which is actually a division of Motown. So this is the first official Motown album, I believe.
Uh-huh.
And she was on Motown, I think, throughout the 80s, at least for the next two albums. And she had a duet with Stevie Wonder on the next one that didn't do much. But she has a lot of different personalities and a lot of different styles she explores on all her albums, but this one, like, it's kind of all over the place, because the next song after that last one is Johnny Doesn't Love Here Anymore, which is it's a great classic country sort of Tammy Wynette type homage, I guess.
Yeah, when I first heard the album, that one kind of surprised me a little bit, because until that song, it's pretty much been a straight line of kind of adult contemporary pop in a way, and then that one sounds pretty, you know, like almost surprisingly twangy or something when it first comes in, because it is so much more country sounding than the other one.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's so different than the song that comes after it too.
I know that I've Never Been to Me was placed on the country charts at that time. I don't know if that was a conscious decision to try and start including, you know, something a little more geared towards that market to try and break her further, but maybe it was just a fluke.
Right.
But
it certainly didn't sound something like Motown would put out.
No, not at all. And I wonder if that might be part of the problem as well. I don't think they really knew how to market her or how to push her in what direction. Because, I mean, it seems like it was unlike anything they'd ever done before then. The next one, I don't actually dislike the next one completely. After the Ball, it's the one that kind of, it sounds like show tunes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that one is definitely the sort of cabaret song on the album.
Yeah, yeah. What did you think of that one?
I would say probably the first half of the album, I think, is stronger than the second. Yeah, but I mean, the country sounding song is sort of a nice surprise, but then after that, I don't know, I kind of feel the same as you. It went downhill a little bit from there, but I wondered what, if you had asked her about that, what she thought about sort of mixing up styles on that album, and is, maybe that was also a problem of kind of cherry-picking songs from, you know, the earlier sessions or the earlier albums that had come out, and that's why maybe they didn't sound like they flowed together as well.
Yeah, I think that's exactly why. At that time, she was pretty much going along with whatever the producers were telling her or the label was telling her. So I think they pretty much had the say in which songs were getting picked for the album. I think there's probably a little bit of regret, maybe. I don't know, regret's maybe a strong word, but I think she, you know, and I understand that, you know, you're young, you're at this, you know, you're with this amazing label who has such a a history and such a, you know, a very clear brand, and you know, the people that were working with her, the songwriters and the producers, I mean, they kind of were calling the shot, that seems like. That next song after that, I Need a Man, she said she really hated that song, but they convinced her to put it on there, and I have to agree with her, it's not a very good song.
Why did she hate it?
She didn't go into a lot of detail about that. I brought up that song because I was going off this whole idea about men writing songs for women and from their viewpoint, and this whole song is about how she just really needs a man, even if it's just kind of fake and it doesn't really mean anything. She's just going to fake it because that's what she does. I mean, she's a woman and she needs a man. So that one's kind of tough to get through.
Well, yeah, one of my first comments when I first heard the whole album was some of the songs are sort of setting feminism back a few years, and I wondered if she sort of had that feeling too about some of the.
I'm pretty sure she did. Yeah, I've got a couple of the lines written down here. Don't you wish you could find a man to stay? That's harsh. And girl, you just need someone to touch and pretend it's real. I mean, I would really love to see a drag queen perform this, but yeah, as it is now, maybe not so much. So that's pretty much it. I agree with you. I think the first half of the album is definitely stronger than the second half, and especially knowing more now. When she was telling me that, you know, it was sort of put together after the surprise success of the single, it kind of does feel that way. You know, it's very much a hodgepodge.
I worry that she got kind of a raw deal in the sense that that song was so big, and then maybe people sort of had their fill of the artist they thought she was. And when you listen to this album, you realize that, you know, there are other songs that she definitely could have had hits with that I'm kind of surprised weren't hits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of frustrating. I feel like if you could just go back and tweak a few things, I think she probably could have had a lot more success.
Mm-hmm.
But I
she should have put a synth pop song on there.
I know. She did. I think I posted that video to you of The Last Dragon. She was in the movie for a few seconds, or I guess her video was. I think it's probably as close as she was ever going to get to synth pop, but. It's a shame she didn't work with the Human League or something like that.
That would have been great.
It would have been. So before moving on to the next album, here's a little chat I recorded recently with Charlene, where she talks about her career, what it was like working with Stevie Wonder, the time Michael Jackson snatched a song out from under her, and an interesting run-in she once had with Dusty Springfield.
Hello?
Hi, is that Charlene?
Yes.
Hey, it's John Mark here from One Hit Wondering. How's it going? I'm pretty good. How are you doing?
I'm just have a sandwich in my mouth.
Oh, well, now you have to tell us what sort of sandwich. It's important.
I'm a gluten-free person. Yeah, I do gluten-free bread with a little bit of turkey and cheese.
See what?
How are you?
I'm all right. I haven't eaten in a long time, so you're making me kind of hungry now.
Oh, no.
It's okay. It's okay. I feel like I've already learned a lot about you just from that little bit there. So I remember you were huge. Definitely. I remember seeing you on Solid. I think it was Solid Gold. They played your video, or you had a. Were you actually performing on Solid Gold? Or
Marilyn McCoo. Do you remember Marilyn McCoo, Fifth Dimension?
I do remember Marilyn McCoo.
She was the host. Uh-huh. And I was on that show a couple times. And that was, but the one that I was on the most was Top of the Pops in England. That was a riot. I did it with ABC. I did the show with Joan Jett. I did shows with all those guys. And I did a lot of them, a lot of shows.
In the last couple of weeks, I saw a video on YouTube of Marilyn McCoo singing I've Never Been to Me.
Are you kidding?
It was, I'm going to be honest with you, it was not very good. God bless her.
Well, she had more of a real, her voice was good, but it was more like a background singing voice. She wasn't really a lead mm-hmm. singer.
Yeah, I like the fifth dimension.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, but on her own, though, like, it was very, like, everything was so well pronounced, like, it was very technical.
Yes, that's how she sings. Yeah, hey lady, you lady.
That's exactly
cursing
it.
At your life, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's like we lost some of the emotion of the lyrics because she was so busy trying to make sure she got the words.
Yeah.
Well, she gave it a go,
She was a love. Is she still around?
I have no idea. We'll have to find out.
I know I met Donna Summer. She passed away. I kind of get her mixed up with Marilyn and sometimes. No. Yeah, Donna was. She had all those really cool dance. She had the dance, the really good disco.
Mm-hmm. Donna Summer?
Disco stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, Donna Summer. She's done some amazing songs.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, so I'm sorry to tell you this, but I have not even asked you my first question off the list. Everything I've asked you has just been off the top of my head. So do you mind, do you mind that I have a lot of questions for you?
Of course I don't mind. That's what I'm here for.
Great. Okay. I'll try to make it as painless as possible.
Okay.
Okay. So my first question, I'm curious about, what were your influences for your album? You can either answer the 1970s version or the 1980s version, but I'm curious who your inspirations were and, what you were kind of fueled by at that time.
My musical influence, mm-hmm. Well, it was the Beatles, and it was the Supremes, and it was the Motown sound. And mainly it was the Beatles. I loved singing strongly along with Paul McCartney and the Wee Hoo. They did a song like, when I woke up this morning, you were on my mind.
Oh, yes.
Do you remember that?
I do know that.
I remember I sang along with that girl because she had a really kind of a low voice, and I loved it. And then she went up, and it kept progressing up and up and up, and it was like, wow, it was awesome. So that was really a neat inspiration. I love that. But I think the Beatles and the Supremes, Diana Ross and the Supremes.
Mm-hmm. So you must have just felt like you were going to go insane when you found out you were going to be actually signed to Motown.
It was like a surreal thing of, no, this cannot be. I mean, it was true. It was happening. It was kind of I got signed quick, but my girlfriend at the time, my girlfriend who we were best friends, she at the time was dating Berry Gordy. So that was my Motown connect. I was like, whoa, you actually... you know all those people, and you know Diana Ross and all that stuff. And yeah, and it was like, so she kind of brought, I told her how much I loved that, and I used to sing along with it. And then when I did my song that Berry Gordy heard and then said, I want to meet Charlene, it was like, oh my God, this is not real. That was when I actually got signed to the company. Because back then, I mean, it was so influential. It was, the Beatles were influenced by Motown. Everybody was, Motown was a surge of inspiration and of style and of the blues with the rock. Not even so much rock. It was the blues with those saxophones and that raw, organic music. Where they used to stomp their feet in the studio. It was just incredible. Yeah.
So what was going on in your life prior to actually signing as a solo artist? I mean, did I read somewhere you were a backing singer for a while?
I sang background for Petula Clark in Vegas at Caesar's Palace. And I was opening up for the Osmond Brothers. And who opened up for them was Joan Rivers.
Oh, wow.
Oh my God!
But Joan Rivers opened up for the Osmond Brothers.
Yeah, and then we came in, we did something, and then the Osmond Brothers were the main show, But Joan was just getting started. We're talking back in the '60s.
You released "I've Never Been to Me" in the '70s.
Yes.
It didn't go anywhere, or didn't go very far. I should say
it went like 97 on the pop chart.
Yeah, and. And so I'm right in saying that the album that you released in the 70s with that song on it is different from the album that you released in the 80s, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. And the Stevie Wonder song, the duet you recorded with him was on the 70s album, right?
That was on the Youth City album. It was a different album. It was the one after I've Never Been to Me. That had a lot of different styles, a lot of different songs on it.
Yeah. What was it like working with Stevie?
Oh, my God, Stevie. Well, I've known Stevie all the time at Motown. I mean, when I first met him, I would, well, all, okay, all the writers, you know, like Norman Whitfield, who wrote War, the most unusual character you'd ever want to meet. I mean, what a trip. Norman Whitfield and the guys who wrote all the big hits for Smokey, and, well, he wrote his own stuff, too. Holland Dozier Holland, Smokey Robinson. Not so much Diana. Michael used to come in as a little boy once I got into the company. We all kind of hung out at the Motown office on 9270, I believe, which is at Sunset Boulevard. And we'd just go hang out there and just writing and listen to the newest songs coming out. And, of course, I worked with every producer on Motown. I worked with Hal Davis, who did all of the Temptations. I worked with Bob Gaudio, who did the Four Seasons. I worked with Smokey. He produced quite a few things on me. So we'd hang out, and one day we're sitting at the piano, and we're just playing around the songs. And Stevie walks in, of course, with his entourage and people that he knew. And he gets to the piano, and Ron is at the piano. Ron Miller, who wrote I've Never Been to Me, the lyrics, is sitting there at the piano, and Stevie walks in and he goes, "Hey man, I want to play you something." So Stevie sits down and I'm sitting there and I'm sitting next to him, and he plays me a song titled Taboo to Love, a song that he just wrote. And he goes, "Hey Charlene, go a third above me." So he starts singing it, and I'm just trying to pick up. I have a really good ear, and I could pick up melody immediately. So he starts playing and singing, and I'm doing a third above him. So Stevie was always, and Ron Miller would come up behind him and put his hands over his eyes and go, "Stevie, guess who?" And Stevie was so awesome. He was fine. He never got insulted, never anything. He was just a very cool guy. So I've known him a lot, but working with him professionally in the studio was a whole different thing. You know, he is it's very hard to get. I mean, we booked studio time with him back in 82, 83, and I think it took us 6 months to get him in the studio.
Wow.
That's how long it took, because he is so, number one, he's very busy. Number two, he has no concept of time. Number three, I think he had a lot of girlfriends or something going on like that, and a lot of people really kind of around him, always wanting his attention. So finally, we got him, and we worked in his studio down on Western Boulevard in Hollywood. So yeah, working with him was just amazing. He is a genius, man. He is just nothing but admiration for him.
So I'm curious how you feel about the first version of the album with I've Never Been to Me, the 70s version, and the 80s version. Do you feel one was better than the other, or one was more in line with what you wanted to do?
I think you're talking about the one that had the talking bit and the one that didn't, right?
Correct, yeah.
Okay.
I'm referring to the albums, though. How do you feel about each album? I mean, since they were both so different.
To be really, really honest with you and to my listeners and people that, you know, are my fans, I was never really crazy about my vocals. I mean, Never Been to Me was an exception. It took us a long, that was magic. We hit magic with that song. We did. I believe we caught lightning in a bottle, as Ron used to say, with that vocal. But the other vocals, I wasn't really mad about. Ron Miller and Kenny Hirsch used to pitch my voice so high up in the key that it made me sing really high and almost very breathy. and it really wasn't me. I mean, I've got more of a, well, now that I'm older, I've got a lower voice, but I always wanted to sing more of a soulful style, almost like Tina Marie. Well, not quite as soul-y as she was, but in that kind of a range, you know, doing more soul. But he had me in this really delicate, almost like a Barry Gibb kind of thing, you know. Mm-hmm. So I liked it. The songs were brilliant. One of my favorite songs was I Won't Remember Ever Loving You. Oh, it was a beautiful song.
I like that one too.
Huh? You like that one too?
Yeah, I made a note of it that I really like this band Bread from the 70s. Remember Bread?
Oh, I love Bread.
I do too. And that song reminded me of Bread.
Oh my gosh. I can't believe you're saying their name. I haven't heard it. It was David Gates.
Mm-hmm.
David Gates. Yeah. That was his name, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And this song, there's definitely that I Won't Remember Loving You is definitely Bready.
You taught me now. Oh my gosh, you're bringing back so many memories to me.
that's love making music.
But yeah, I mean, for me, it was just, I would have liked to have had more of a stronger, you know, way of singing. But that was Ron's producing.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the style. He always used to say to me, you know, it's almost like the Frank Sinatra style of music, but with your breathy, sweet, breathy voice. And that's what he loved. And being new, I took his instruction and I believed him. And he's a brilliant writer. I mean, the things that he wrote, and, you know, he was great.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Tina Marie a minute ago. There was one song, I think it was Can't We Try, that really reminds me of Tina Marie.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, that was a great song.
Mm-hmm.
One of the worst songs on the album is After the Ball. I don't know if you've heard that.
I have. I've heard that whole album. It's show tunesy.
It's very show tunesy. It's so show tune. But it's so, oh my God, I can't even think about that song. I hated it.
That's the worst, when you've committed something, you know, and it's out there forever and you're just not happy with it.
I know, it's out there and you can't do anything about it.
I will say, though,
some people love it.
I think it's actually I think it's all right. You know, I think it's good in that album because it breaks things up. You know, it's just a curveball. You know, you don't see it coming, and you know, it kind of shows you doing something different, which I think is good. So I want to ask you about the producers that you worked with on the 1982 album: Barry Gordy, Ron Miller, Don Costa. Was it a good experience? I take it.
Well, we went into the studio and we had all the band, all the musicians there, and the violins all come in. There was got to be about 20 violins, and all the drums and the guitars and the whatever else they use in the orchestra, a harp. There was a harpist there. And Ron said to me, you know, I mean, Ron said, Char, go take lunch. We're just going to put this all together. It's going to be kind of boring hearing, you know, getting all the, you know, Don Costa, who did all Frank Sinatra stuff. He was the sweetest, most wonderful man. He passed away from cancer years ago. Loved him, just a doll. He did all the conducting and wrote all the charts. Barry Gordy loved the song and loved Ron, and just ever so he got involved in it too. And of course, Ron wrote it, so he was involved. But I went out to lunch, and I was out for a while, out for a couple hours. And I came back into Hitsville, you know, down in Santa Monica, or I think it's Santa Monica, or one of those streets down there in Hollywood. And I walk in and I'm hearing these violins. And I'm going, man, what song is that? That's beautiful. And I walk in and I'm getting closer. It's my studio. And I'm like, holy no. And I'm like, I walk in and it's the most beautiful violin line. If you listen to the end of I've Never Been to Me, the violin music, the music from the violins is going, and that's all I heard. And it was just like, I started crying. I started just crying. And Ron goes, he had a really deep voice, like kind of like God, really low, deep voice. And he goes, so how do you like your song, baby? And I went, oh my God, what part is this? What part? and it was magical. I will never forget that moment for as long as I live.
So that was in the 70s, right, when it was first recorded?
That was like 76.
Mm-hmm.
76.
I'm curious, when this all came up again in 1982 and the song started kind of going crazy, you hadn't intended on releasing that album with that song again.
I had no idea this was going on. I had been on the label since 1972, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, like 1979. I was been on the label for like 7 years. I was on the label 7, 8 years. And I had recorded all these songs, album after album, song after song. I mean, I did a song with Hal Davis called Number One. I did the Michael Jackson hit, and I did the demo of it, One Day in Your Life. That was my song. I did that, and
really?
Then I ended up by giving it to Michael. Okay, but I know it's been a trip.
Oh wow,
crazy!
That is amazing.
I know they gave it to him and he got the hit. I'm like, that was my song. I think they even used my same track. I had all these different producers working with me. And until Ron approached me in the 70s and said, I've been hearing your voice and I've got a song I want you to hear. This is how this whole thing happened. Okay? He goes, I've got to play you a song. And I've been doing all these songs. I'm going, okay, yeah. So, you know, I'm there, and I walk into his little office. He closes the door, and he pushes the button, and this lady says, hey, lady. And at that time in my life, I was with a very abusive husband. He was, like, hitting me and hurting me and just really bad. And I hear this, you're a discontented mother and a regimented wife. I've no doubt you dream about the things you'll never do. And I just broke down. This guy, Ron Miller, I'd never met him in my life. He's this big, white Jewish guy with his blue eyes and these big, bushy eyebrows and black hair. And he's sitting there looking at me, and he stops the tape because I was sobbing. Because I was sobbing for me, for my life, and what I've been going through, and, you know, just feeling so depressed and not knowing what to do, and all these songs I've done, and nothing happened. So this is getting to the part where I left music totally, okay? So we did I've Never Been to Me. That whole thing with hearing the violins and Berry Gordy and Don Costa and Ron Miller and getting treated like a queen and this is going to be huge and yada, 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 yada. And then it flops. 90 on the charts and nobody really seemed to care. And I didn't do the talking part of it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't talk on it. It was just the music. Everybody was like, oh, the talking part's corny. Nobody's going to want to hear that. But they don't realize that the talking part was the guts of the song. Hey, you know what paradise is? Why? A fantasy we create about people and places as we'd like them to be. But you know what truth is? It's that little baby you're holding, and it's that man you fought with this morning. The same one you're going to make love with tonight. That's truth. That's love. You know what? That was the guts of the song. Okay, I had left Motown. I left. I thought if this thing's not a hit and Motown's not behind it, then you know what? I'm in the wrong business. I'm just, even though I loved it and I was passionate, I loved it so much, I just said, nah, ain't happening anymore. I got to get out of this. It's going to kill me. My heart was broken time after time after time. I just kept getting a broken heart with all these songs and Michael getting that song and me, you know, being, you know, I didn't get that song and this and that. So anyway, I was living, I met Jeff Oliver, who was at my church in L.A., and we fell in love, and he said, come back to England, I want to marry you. I said, okay, I'm coming. So I went back to England and basically kissed music goodbye for a while until I got a phone call from my mom about, oh God, it must have been seven, eight months later. I don't remember how long. And she said, Charlene, somebody from Motown's looking for you. And I'm like, what? I mean, I've been off the label for a while. Then about, I don't know how many days or week, whatever, Jay Lasker called me. and said, your song's a number 30 with a double bullet, not single, double. This thing was selling, I heard it was selling 66,000 records a day.
That's crazy.
And I'm like, you've got to be joking me. And the next thing I know, I'm on Concorde Airlines flying to New York doing Good Morning America with Barry Gibb. Maurice Gibb of the Bee Gees.
Did you have another album ready, or did you have to hurry and go in the studio and record something else to release
this
album?
They put together all the songs that we had on the album. But they just wanted to focus on the single at first, but of course they put an album together too.
Mm-hmm.
They conglomerated it with all the stuff that Ron Miller and Kenny Hirsch and I did for, you know, 2 or 3 years of all the stuff. So they threw that album together quick because they just found me. And I even had offers to go work in. I mean, I had nothing. I'm sitting in England. I was settling down, not looking into keeping going in music. I didn't want music anymore. I'd been so, not burned. I had so many experiences that were amazing, but I just got fed up. Especially after I've Never Been to Me. You know, the thing with Michael and, you know, him taking one day in your life, that was fine, you know, but after I've Never Been to Me, that's what broke my heart. I was like, if that song, I loved it. I loved that song. And we worked so hard on it. Yeah, it was amazing. So that was what kind of broke, the straw that broke the camel's back, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of it.
Yeah, that's understandable.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, right after the success of I've Never Been to Me, was the follow-up single, was it It Ain't Easy Coming Down?
Yes, one of my favorites. I forgot about that song. That was beautiful.
It is a really good song. Do you have any idea why, or do you have any feelings for why maybe it didn't make as big as an impact? Because it's kind of similar lyrically, and it's kind of in that same world.
You know what? Jay Lasker, the same guy who found me and praised me and believed in me, was the same guy. It wasn't Barry. Barry loved me. But Jay Lasker probably convinced everybody that I was just a fluke. And I was just a one-time wonder, and they kind of didn't pursue it. And I'm not sure if that was the problem or if Ron Miller kind of hurt my career, because he kind of guarded me against a lot of people. You know, I had a lot of people that wanted to work with me, and he stepped in, and I gotta blame myself for a lot of that, because I allowed him to kind of take charge of my career. And we had a relationship. We're in a romantic relationship as well, which didn't help anything. So it just kind of went south. I didn't really, and it was sad, but what can you do? You know, things like that happen. Not every artist gets 2 or 3, 4 hits, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And just wasn't meant to be, or it just didn't happen, or maybe I just trusted in the wrong people, you know.
Did you have any input in writing those songs at all?
I wrote some of If You Take Away the Pain Until the Morning. I wrote some of that. I wrote the music with Ron.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I wrote Richie's song. Another song called Richie's Song that got on the album, which kind of went along for the ride. It was okay, but I wasn't in the class of Kenny and Ron. Oh my gosh, no way. And they were on a roll, you know, writing all these incredible songs.
How do you feel about, one thing I was thinking about when I was listening to your album is, you know, these songs were written by men for women. And so they're kind of, they're putting word, and you know, this, you know, obviously it goes back as long as country music and pop music has been written. I mean, you know, there's been women singing men's songs, but I'm always curious about how it feels like when you're singing a song that was written by a man, and it's a woman's perspective, and they're kind of, and the example here is your song, I Need a Man. So they're sort of, they're putting words in your mouth about how you really need a man. And I
hated that song. I didn't want to do that song. And they were like, oh, but everybody loves it. And I was like, okay, God, I hated it.
Yeah, it's not the strongest song on the album.
No, it's terrible. It's terrible. And that man that goes, I'll call you, baby. You hear that voice?
Yes.
That is Ron Miller.
If you had written these things, I would totally go along with it. But, like, knowing that a guy wrote those for you to sing, I...
No, I know. I hated it.
It's crazy.
I hated it. Okay, we had Hal David and Burt Bacharach writing everything for Dionne Warwick, but it was, do you know the way to San Jose? More joyful, fun, you know, the preacher man, take the hand of the preacher, you know. What was that song that they wrote? That was Dusty Springfield.
Oh, I love Dusty. I'm a huge Dusty
fan. Oh, do you want to know something funny?
Yes, please.
I was up at Motown, and I met Dusty. She was up there, and she was one of my favorite artists. Oh, my God, I met her. And I leave the room, and she says to the person, is Charlene gay? Because I'm gay, and I'm...
You could have had an affair with Dusty. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, my God. I'm kidding. I would have been more famous.
Oh, man, that's amazing.
Oh, my God, I'm like, no, don't go there, no. I got hit on my Dusty Springfield. She was another one of my favorite artists, but I could never go as high and as strong as she could. She had a good, high, strong head voice.
Not many people could go that high or that strong. That's,
no, she
had quite
I know. She was amazing.
How do you feel about your later material compared to your early material?
Well, I'm going to tell you a story. I had a guy call me. I was kind of, you know, people knew me. This writer wants to meet you, Charlene. His name is Eric something. I can't remember his last name. He came to my house, and he said, Charlene, I want to play you this song. I think you could nail it. And we go in my mom's car, because I was in my car at the time, and we sit in the car and put the tape on. And it goes, I'm just going to sing a little bit of the melody. I'm going to sing you the chorus. We belong to the light. Belong to the thunder. We belong.
That's a good song. I know that one.
You know that one?
Yeah.
Pat Benatar.
Yeah.
It was supposed to be for me. And I brought it to my executive producers at Motown. And she goes, oh, no, that's not a very good song. I said, it's brilliant. This guy wants to give me first shot to sing it. Please. I'd love to do it. And they're like, no, that's not good. That's not Motown enough, or not what you're kind of. And I'm like, oh, great. So I'm driving about 6 weeks later, whatever. And it comes on the radio. I almost smashed my car. I was like, that was supposed. Well, good for Eric. It's all awesome for him. But I'm like, that was supposed to be for me.
It sounds like they didn't really know how to handle you, or they didn't know which direction.
They didn't know where to put me. They didn't know where to put me in the beginning, and they didn't know where to put me after I had my hit. But see, if I would have been taken under the wing of like Smokey or somebody, I think I would have more flourished into more of the soul-y stuff.
What I was just thinking when you said that is I think just for your own satisfaction, I feel like you should record your own version of We Belong to the Night and just post it up on YouTube or something, and, you know.
Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah. I mean, you could just do like an acoustic guitar or a piano or something, you know, and make it your own.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, yeah. That's a good idea.
Yeah, right the wrongs.
Holy smokes. I like that idea.
Because it is a perfect song for you. I can totally hear you nailing that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely.
I think that's actually all my questions, too.
Okay.
Oh, I do have one other question. Just in case somebody wants to check out what you're doing, do you keep a web presence? Is there a website people can go to keep track of you?
Oh, website. It's www.charlenesongs.com.
All right. Well, it's been great meeting you, or sort of meeting you, over the phone.
Talking.
Yes. Thank you for being so kind to talk to me.
Oh, it's awesome. I Love it. Thank you so much.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll be in touch.
Okay. Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Okay, next up we have our second album of the day. It is the self-titled album from the Tom Tom Club. It came out in 1981. The Tom Tom Club essentially were Tina Weymouth and Chris Franz from Talking Heads, along with a lot of other guest collaborators. It's a pretty special album. Okay, so we're going to get right to it. I love this album. I'm going to go ahead and spoil my verdict of it. I think it's really solid all the way through. Like you, I had it in high school. I had the 12-inch single. I think I had one or two 12-inch singles from it, and I really loved it then. I really love it now. I think it's aged so well. I think the production is great on it.
I do, too. I think it's just as well as any Talking Heads album, really. I love the early Talking Heads, especially the ones produced by Brian Eno, the most. So those are definitely sort of, strongest and closest to my heart. But yeah, I'm surprised how much I still love this one too, and how much I felt like it held up.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I don't think there's a bad track on this album, and I'm specifically referring to I believe it's the original U.S. release that did not have Under the Boardwalk on it. I think there was just 8 songs on this one, but I remember my first experience with this very vividly. I was watching TV. Do you remember that show Livewire that was on Nickelodeon?
Livewire?
Yeah.
Is that right?
If you look it up, did you watch Nickelodeon when you were a kid?
A little bit.
Yeah. Well, there was a show called Livewire. You might, if you looked it up, you might recognize it. But it was like sort of a kid's show, and there was like a host, and they'd have people come on and talk, and it was a lot of different things. But I just remember they showed the video for this song. And this is the first time I think I ever saw anything that was a little, had some underground leanings, it was something a little out there and a little weird. And it kind of blew my mind. I remember looking at watching the video on TV and just being like, what is this? This is awesome. Because it didn't look like anything else I'd seen, It was very, very, the video was just great. Very, very freaky. So, yeah, and of course the song, to see the video and hear the song at the same time for the first time, it was a revelation, because I thought the song was just so incredible, too. The album starts with Wordy Rapping Hood, which I think is as good of a song as Genius of Love.
It's such a strange song. It's this weird hybrid of adult pop music and kids' playground music, and it reminds me of... the whole album sort of reminds me of that, but especially the first song on it reminds me so much of something that you'd see on Electric Company with the chanting and the lyrics about words. It sounds strange today, but I can imagine it was really strange back then.
Yeah, that song is just so well put together. It's such a good example, I think, of that sort of sound that was coming out of New York at the time, like that scene with like Arthur Russell and Klaus Nomi and ESG. It's like sort of post-punk, post-disco, synth-pop. And it's such a good balance of all those things. And then from there we go to Genius of Love, which, again, it sounds great now. Partly maybe because it's been sampled so many times, it still seems really fresh and it's very innovative.
In America, that's really the only one that a lot of people know. Although I know Wordy Rapping Hood was a bigger hit in a lot of countries in Europe.
Officially, in America, the Genius of Love is the only one that broke the top 40. Which I was a little surprised by that when I found that out. I don't remember really hearing that song on the radio much. I remember seeing the video, of course, and hearing about it. But it wasn't like played, with Styx and Journey,
Right.
Not in West Texas, anyway. Maybe other bigger cities. And after that, we have an instrumental, the Tom Tom theme, which I think all good albums need an instrumental. So that's a really good little bridge into the rest of it.
Yeah, it's the strange thing to me is, and I wonder if this was the original plan, in the 80s, a lot of bands had, like, something theme that either, I don't know, it seemed like those songs either opened the album or were the last song on side one. I can think of so many sort of new wave albums from the 80s that have the last song on side one be like kind of the closeout theme of that side. So it's strange for me that they put it kind of right there in the middle after the first two kind of popular hit songs. I wonder if that was their original intention or if that's something that record company had them do if they wanted them to put the first two songs first.
Yeah, you have to kind of always remember that. You have to remind yourself that it was all about side one and side two and how important it was
right.
to have just the right opening for each side and closing for each side, you know. And I kind of miss that because it's all part of the art of putting an album together. It's like knowing how it's going to flow and how
exactly.
the impact will
yeah.
be. You know, like
I definitely miss that too.
Yeah, like David Bowie's Low album. The way, like, the B-side is the instrumental section of that album. And, it's nice having that little separation.
And there was always the chance that you're going to accidentally put on side two first, which I did for many, many albums when I first heard them. And so I would think that this was the opening song on the album. But I guess it's never a problem now.
Yeah. No, unfortunately not. A lot of the accidents, just, you know, potential for accidents has been taken away.
Talking about that, which do you prefer of the Pound Pound Club album, the first side or the second?
I would have to go with side A, really, because I really like the La Elephant as well.
Uh-huh.
That's such a good song.
I don't know. I also love the first two songs on side two, but I mean, we can get to that in a second. But once again, it's just such a strong album. I think almost every song on it is really strong.
And I think that's one of the things I've enjoyed most about putting the show together is that it's forcing me to sit down and focus on an album from beginning to end, and that's really nice.
Mm-hmm. This album, I think, also it. The songs are individual, but it seems like it really sort of flows together as one whole.
I thought the exact same thing listening to it last night.
Yeah.
Because it's all painted with a very similar palette, which I think a lot of bands, that can be a problem, you know, maybe start sounding a little samey, but I think the songs are so good on this album, I think it works in its favor. It does feel very connected.
Yeah, and you know, there's recurring sounds, and the synth sounds are sort of recurring and similar on some of the songs, and I don't know, I kind of like it as a whole piece. And you know, obviously there are the standout songs, which are the singles and the ones that people remember, but when you hear the whole album, it, you know, there's things that sort of recur and sounds that recur, and I don't know, just the sort of uniqueness of the vocal makes it interesting in that sense, like the background vocals, especially the way they sort of recur from song to song. I like that a lot.
Yeah, I do too. I think the vocals are beautiful. If I remember correctly, I think she's got like her sisters singing with her on these.
Right.
It's like three
right.
Weymouths. And it just sounds heavenly. It really does. It's really nice. And they had, I think Adrian Belew's playing guitar on some of this, and he was playing on Talking Heads, I think, around that same time maybe, or maybe a little later after this.
Yeah, he has such a sort of distinctive style. You can really tell right away that that's him on the guitar. And her bass is amazing.
Yeah, it is really good.
It's interesting to me to sort of compare this album to the album Mesopotamia by B-52s, which came out the next year. And that was produced by David Byrne. But some of the songs are really similar. The song Lorelei, which is, I think, the sixth track, the second song on side two, it sounds really similar to the song Deep Sleep, which is on the Mesopotamia album. It's funny, like B-52s went down that direction with that album and used David Byrne as the producer, and it's just obvious that that was so sort of influenced by the sound that both Talking Heads and Tom Tom Club were sort of going for at that time, using a lot of percussion and that sort of Adrian Blue guitar sound, a really heavy bass and rhythm section. They're both amazing albums, actually one of my favorite B-52s albums, and it's, I haven't heard this Tom Tom Club in a while, but it was interesting to me how similar they do sound.
There's aspects of this album, and well, obviously with the Talking Heads, but there was moments that remind me a little bit of My Life in the Bush of Ghosts as well. It has that sort of really tight rhythm.
Yeah, My Life in the Bush of Ghosts was recorded right after Fear of Music, I think. But then I cannot in 81. So, yeah, this must have been around must have come out around the same time.
Yeah. It was a good time for music. That's my verdict. It was a good time for music. And it's a short album, too. I mean, we're already at the end of it pretty much here. The last track was mostly instrumental, some brief vocal passages, which, again, I really like these little instrumental sections of the album.
I love the percussion on this album, not just Chris Franz's drums, but also just the sort of background percussion. They use this instrument a lot, which I had to look up because I couldn't remember the name of it. It's called the Wiro or the Gyro.
Mm-hmm.
It's like that gourd with grooves in it, and you use a stick to sort of scrape the grooves. The song Lorelei, there's that instrument going the entire time in the background. And when you listen to it on headphones, you just sort of get entranced by it and just sort of fixate on that sound. And there's so many other sort of little freaky percussion instruments that are going on in the background really busily in all these songs on the album.
So, scale 1 to 10 for Charlene and for the Tom Tom Club. You must grade them.
It's the scale according to if it's a scale of 70s, early 80s, adult contemporary pop for Charlene. If that's the case, then she's right up there at a 9 or a 10. As for Tom Tom Club, it's just straight ahead 10, I think. Especially considering how often they've been sampled as time has gone on, and just sort of how influential they've been. Even when you're just considering Genius of Love, how influential that song's been on sort of, you know, generations now of people. I mean, people know that song whether they know it's Tom Tom Club or not, just because Mariah Carey, you know, sampled it so heavily for one of her.
Yeah.
So I'd have to give Tom Tom Club a 10. I don't know. What about you?
I'm right there with you. I think Tom Tom Club is 10 plus. I like your answer to Charlene. I love her voice. If you look back, look at the time it came out and the fact that the songs that came out in the 80s were actually from the 70s, you know, they had been cast adrift into time and kind of didn't find their footing in the 80s. So, but there's definitely some great moments on there, especially considered that it was sort of cobbled together to sort of, you know, coincide with the hit, I've Never Been to Me. So
I think she's definitely worth people checking out and sort of getting to know on a more serious kind of basis as a singer.
I totally agree with you, Scott. Absolutely. All right, and that's it for the show. I've got no more to give these two albums. I've spent a lot of time with them the last 2 weeks, and I'm going to let them go now until I listen to them again, of course. I do have one tie-in to your First Time I Heard series. I had a little quiz question for you I was going to ask you.
Okay.
Are you ready? I see there are at least two of your First Time I Heard subjects that qualify as one-hit wonders here in the U.S. I'm curious if you know who they are and what the songs are.
I don't. You've stumped me.
It'll be obvious to you when I tell you what they are. At least one of them will. So, first one is Kate Bush, Running Up That Hill.
Right.
And the second one is Kraftwerk, The Autobahn.
See, it's so difficult because both of those artists are so huge everywhere else. So
I know.
I always forget.
Yeah, it is weird. I mean, it blows my mind really, that Kraftwerk hit number 25 in the U.S. pop charts with Autobahn. I mean, a 20-minute synth song. It's just baffling. I mean, that it was such a different world then.
Yeah, and if someone said, you know, if someone said one hit of Kraftwerk during their entire career is going to be charting in America, you know, you, that's not really the one you would guess.
No, I would have guessed, like, either Music Nonstop or, even though I don't think that would have ever charted, but Tour de France, probably, just because it was on a lot of, it was, you know, that's when breakdancing was taking off, and I know that song was on
Or The Model, maybe, or...
Yeah, The Model. But, yeah, I mean, yeah. That Model was a hit, I think, everywhere but the U.S.
Right.
Yeah, it's so baffling.
Maybe one of them will... Kraftwerk or Kate Bush will still have a hit in America someday. I got it, though.
It's not too late, but probably not. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John Mark.
I really appreciate it. I think you've given a lot of insight and perspective into this, so it's very much appreciated.
Well, it's been fun. It's been great to listen to these albums again.
Yeah, absolutely, and I'd love to get you on here again, and we can pick a couple of more if you're up for it and sometime in the future.
Oh, sure. I have lots of ideas. So.
Excellent. Well, feel free to send them to me. And, I'll talk to you soon.
All right.
Bye-bye. Before we wrap it up, I want to recommend you check out another show on the Dream Spectrum Media Podcast Network. It's called the Kraft Music Discovery Podcast, and it's hosted by D. Grant Smith. It explores new and up-and-coming indie songwriters, and it's a great show. You can find it and more information about One Hit Wondering at dreamspectrummedia.com. That's it for this installment of the show. If you have a suggestion for a one-hit album that we should look at, why not write to us? You can send an email to onehitwondering@gmail.com. That's the number one, hit wondering, all one word, @gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.
This has been a production of the Dream Spectrum Media Podcast Network.